welcome to the Oldie Writing Course with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie. We've got terrific speakers, Mary Kenny on how to write a column, Sam Leith, the Spectator's literary editor, on how to write a review, William Cook, the Oldie's theatre critic, on how to write a travel feature, and Elizabeth Luard, our cookery correspondent, on how to write the Substack. And here this is the brilliant Mary Kenny, who is a distinguished columnist on the Oldie and is one of the three people still writing in the Oldie who wrote in the very first edition in 1992 for Richard Ingram's when he came up with the brilliant idea of the Oldie. She's an extremely distinguished journalist, first started writing in 1966, is that right, Mary?
64.
Yes, yeah. So it's the 61st anniversary of her writing. She's written for everyone from the Oldie to the Standard, the Times, the Guardian, the Telegraph, the Spectator, the Irish Times. I could go on all day. A distinguished writer of books as well. She wrote a terrific book, The Crown and the Shamrock, about the relationship between Ireland and the monarch, and wrote a terrific book about Lord Haw-Haw, called Germany Calling. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm very pleased to be introducing Mary Kenny, who's going to be talking about how to write a column. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Harry. And it's awfully kind of you to say I'm distinguished, but I really am just a humble scribe, honestly, who survived for 60 years in the media. And Harry's own address really reminded me, however long you are a journalist, you really learn, you're still absolutely learning all the time. And I suppose that's true of any profession, really. I love the idea in the ballet and in the music world where people always have both a teacher and a pupil throughout their life. And I'd like to see that more of that in the media. And I suppose, going back to the olden days when journalists met each other much more, I mean, you did meet older journalists and you'd listen to their stories and you'd listen to their funny, you know, their funny stories and their scandalous stories in El Vino. And that was a wonderful apprenticeship. And I suppose one of the sadder things today, although we have much better communications, is that, you know, things are done by email, things are done by remote control, so you don't so often meet the colleagues that you work with or the people you work for, and I think that is a loss. I mean, Harry mentioned, by the way, about wordage and the number of words, and of course we are lucky today that the computer counts it, because you know, back in the day you had to count it yourself with the typewriter, and it was about 10 to 12 words a line, and then you added it all up, you know. So I go back to that. You know, I go on, I'm not really much of a techie, but I do go on social media and I do go on what is called Twitter, and that's a bit of an eye-opener, actually. And people on Twitter can be terribly rude, you know, as well as they can be very informative, of course, as well. And sometimes if they don't like what you've said or what you've posted, sometimes they've said to me, "You stupid old bag, what are you still doing? You're far too old to have an opinion, you know, for heaven's sake, get back in your box." They do that sort of thing, you know. And my answer to that is, my age is my asset, actually. I can go back a long way, I can remember a lot of things, I can experience a lot of things, you know, and a lot of the things that people are talking about today, I remember people talking about 50 years ago. I mean, we have had this drama about poor Ruth Ellis, the last woman to be hanged. Well, I remember, you know, back in the 60s, there was passionate conversations about that. One of the conversations was that she'd have walked free from a French court because under the crime passionnel exception in France. So, and here it comes round again, but you know, one remembers these things, and I think any of us who are vintage, as the Duchess of Sussex calls it, she says, you don't ask your age anymore, you say, what vintage are you? But those of us who are vintage should look on ages as our strength and our asset and our superpowers, in a way. And I think it is awfully nice to see people like Lise Doucette, you know, on television reporting. She's absolutely terrific, and she's a very mature woman, actually, and they don't try to make out that she's a young woman who's just starting, and a young woman who's just starting needs her breaks and, of course, has strengths as well. But it's good to see experienced operators in the media like that. So we should look on all of that. I say I'm a Hummel scribe. I have survived the media for 60 plus years, and it's been a great experience, and often actually a painful experience. As Harry said, you get lots of rejection, you get lots of disappointment, you'd make lots of mistakes. I mean, that's the thing. You get sent to jobs that you're not good enough at. You have to keep trying, and you're learning from your mistakes and accepting a kind of humility of having failed at something and trying again. But I think perseverance is a very important element, you know, in this. I love the quote that Dolly Parton's famous for, when she said, "You wouldn't believe how much money it takes to look this cheap." And I sometimes think that about writing something which can seem like a simple column or a simple article. You mightn't believe how much input it takes sometimes, how much you must keep reading books, you must keep taking notes, you must have a notebook in which you note everything, in which any idea that you've got gets written down so that it can be developed. You wouldn't believe how much thinking and cogitating on something that it might take to write something which looks very, very simple. And sometimes columns which look as though they've just been, you know, tossed off quite kind of easily may have had quite a lot of thought and quite a lot of work and quite a lot of revision in them. So I do think, it can be quite labour intensive. Of course, as Harry says, if you're a specialist in something, that's the really very good angle to know about something. And you can keep developing that all the time. Now, the format, of course, of the column has changed very much over the years, especially because when I first started in the 1960s, there weren't very many columnists. A main newspaper would have perhaps one important or two important columnists. We'd have somebody like my old boyfriend, Bernard Levin, would be the focus, you know, of a column in the Daily Mail and then in the Times. And somebody like Catherine Whitehorn was, you know, she really was the pioneer of what's considered to be the woman's page columnist. And there were many distinguished followers, especially Jenny Cooper, you know, who developed that genre very much and made it sort of quite funny and amusing. And that whole area then developed throughout the 1970s and 1980s, and the woman's column became sort of jokingly called Glenda Slag, the Glenda Slag column, which was a sort of, I suppose it was a take on these great columnists, the very famous Fleet Street columnists like Jean Rook and Linda Lee Potter in the Express of the Mail. And in their day, you know, these were very big names. And I suppose I do sometimes reflect, you know, about the ephemeral aspect of journalism, because these people were terribly famous in their day, have more or less been forgotten, or they're just, you know, like names on the wall here. So journalism does have that ephemeral element, and as Harry says, if you really want to have your name remembered, you have to put it in a book, because a book stays on deposit. It's always there in the library, or it can always be accessed in the British Library, whereas journalism is writing on water. I mean, it is a wonderful career, and it's a wonderful experience, and it's a wonderful discipline, but it does disappear, and I think, you know, one has to be aware of that. I suppose, looking back in the early years, also, what's changed now is that there are very many more columnists. I suppose a newspaper like The Times would give a range of columnists because they want people to have a range of different views coming from different angles, which I think is fair enough. But I think the other thing is because there's so much information all the time, there's such a huge amount of information out there that life is actually quite, you know, confusing, really. You don't really know what to think sometimes. It's a rather odd thing for a columnist to say, because back in the day, the idea was that you might have a very strong opinion about something, and that having a strong opinion was really what sold the column. That sometimes still happens quite a bit. I mean, you have amusing columnists like Rod Liddell in the Sunday Times, who always has a kind of pretty strong opinion about something. I found myself, I've had lots of strong opinions, but I kept changing them, you know. And I've found over the years that my opinions have sort of have become more measured, really. And I find it harder, less comfortable to have a very strong black and white view. I mean, I am would be very interested and concerned, for example, about something like the assisted dying bill. I do think it's a very, very serious question. And, you know, coming from a sort of Christian point of view, you know, I would have the opinion you can't bump people off. But on the other hand, it's very, very complicated when people really do want to bring their life to an end. So I think it's harder to have a black and white opinion, but maybe that makes it more interesting for somebody who can really probe that subject. And I feel great benefit to when I read somebody who is actually experienced in this field who can write something. A palliative doctor will describe their experiences, or perhaps a psychiatrist who has tended people who are coming to the end of their lives, and whether they are position of mind. So, I mean, I think that's an example of an area where there's a huge amount of information, a huge amount of interest, and sometimes rather difficult sphere in which to come to a conclusion. But again, you know, a personal experience there, you know, is really, I think, can make a very good column. I mean, when my brother was dying of cancer back in the 1980s, there was a very zealous young doctor said, let's put up a life support system to sustain life. And it was actually a nun who was a chaplain there said, no, don't put up an artificial. Help him, you know, give him comfort, and let nature take its course, you know. And I thought, and that was something that I remembered so much. So I would draw upon that idea of letting nature take its course if possible. But other people would have, of course, a lot of different ideas. And I'm just noting that field as an area of discourse. And of course, as Harry also said about knowing that your market is a very important area of what you're going to be writing about. I mean, you can't, if you're going to write for the Catholic Herald, it's not going to be the same article as if you're going to write for the Muslim Mirror, you know, obviously. We don't perhaps, as journalists, we don't perhaps have the luxury that philosophers and novelists have. I mean, Sartre was interested in this question, who do I write for? And he came to the conclusion, I write for myself, really. And I think that's an admirable position to be in, to be able to say I write for myself. But, of course, you have to be what the French so rightly call a public intellectual, I suppose, before you can get to that point. Whereas the journalist, I think, does have to consider the market and, you know, read absolutely the newspaper or magazine that you're writing for. When I was, as it were, doing my apprenticeship with the Evening Standard under Charles Winter, father of the more famous Dame Anna Winter. I mean, he had this thing which he drummed into all of us. Where's the London angle? You know, this is the London Evening Standard. So therefore, where is the London angle to this story? You know, and although it seems a little bit kind of restrictive to look at it that way. It nevertheless gets across the idea that the people who are reading this particular paper are in the London area, and they're not necessarily going to be all that interested in the common agricultural policy, because, you know, there aren't many farms, you know, in the West End. So it did, that sort of taught me to think in terms of the readership and what sort of reader that you're aiming at, or that you're sort of feeling comfortable with. I suppose the other thing I've asked myself sometimes is, what is a column for? It's a particular writer's take on something, and there can be a different reasons for the writer can provide different assets, if you like. Sometimes the writer depends on personality. I mean, somebody like Julie Burchill, I think, or there's a very malicious but clever writer on the Daily Mail called Jan Moyer, and she writes quite a lot about how terrible the Duchess of Sussex is and how awful her Netflix programmes are. She does it very wittily and very malicious. It's really, I suppose, the art of the invective, which is part of a journalistic tradition, of course. Going back to Jonathan Swift. And I suppose people might read that sort of column, which is very well done, to sort of take pleasure in the malice, almost, you know, because malice can be funny, I'm afraid, and it can be amusing. But you then have a columnist who entertain. Now, of course, Charles Brandreth, I think, is always wonderful for that, and columnists who inform. And I do think Andrew Wilson, A.N. Wilson, who writes, you know, for us on the OD, you know, you can always depend on him about, you know, if he's writing about history or the Church of England or literature, that he knows what he's saying, that there's a dependency. You can depend on that columnist who knows their onions. It's like Steve Rosenberg on the BBC, you know, who's been in Russia for so long and who speaks Russian. You know he knows what he's talking about. But sometimes a columnist is there to sort of just to be rather elegant and a kind of bring us into a world which we're not part of. And there's a columnist on the FT on a Saturday called Yanan Ganesh, and he's really has an extraordinary persona. This persona that he's got is that he's a sort of international boulevardier who sort of roams around the world and eats at the best restaurants and, you know, knows people and is completely detached from place or family. I mean, he might be in Los Angeles. He's the absolute definition of the notion of the person who's an anywhere person. And he's sort of quite annoying because he has this rather smug and very pleased with himself. But at the same time, he's taking you into this world which you'll never be in yourself, in a way, and you maybe wouldn't want to be in yourself. And I suppose, and that's another kind of area where I think the columnist is serving a purpose. So if you become a columnist, maybe you have to decide, what is my purpose? What kind of columnist am I? What am I offering? What's my natural kind of outlet, or my natural form of communication? And that could be, of course, there's such a range of things, and there are all those magazines in a good W.H. Smith, at a railway W.H. Smith, you do have this vast range of magazines to see. I mean, people are saying the printed word is dying, but you do have still an awful lot of the printed word in the form of magazines and newspapers too, although print newspapers are, of course, declining. But there's always a space there somewhere for in which you can express yourself, in which you can find what you want to write. I mean, I have a friend, a local friend, who his life was more or less in show business, but he developed an interest really in the countryside, and he did he did write a lot then for Country Life, which is a very interesting magazine and has its own sort of special take on life in England. But I look on. I ask myself, what is my purpose? What is my? Well, you might say, I don't think I've got a unique selling point, and I think my opinions have watered down over the years. But I look on the column that I write in the ODI. Look on it as a conversation with friends, if possible. Because I feel I know the kind of readers who are reading the oldie, and I feel we share a generational experience, and we share, I think, a feeling that life maybe shouldn't always be taken too seriously either, you know, that there's sorts of funny and quirky things happening in life. There was a lovely old Irish actor, well, actually he was a fake Irishman, really, called Micheál MacLiamore. And he had a show called I Must Be Talking to My Friends. And actually, coincidentally, I see it's coming up. There's a sort of imitation of the show coming up at the German Street Theatre shortly. But I think that is a nice idea, a nice caption too for a conversational. I must be talking to my friends. I must feel that there is a connection with the readers and sort of with my friends. The big currency in journalism and in writing a column is ideas, you know, and that's what you have to look for all the time, is ideas, or how an idea can be developed from an event or from a book, a movie, from experiences throughout the world. And I think that obviously with things that sort of happen, that all many tragic things that happen, or the sort of quirky, funny things that happen. But whatever it is has to be written down every single day. That notebook has to be filled with ideas that can be perhaps developed, you know, can be researched much more. So that is the... And, you know, there are many sort of complex ideas which... I sometimes feel, you know, need a lot of work, and I wonder if the work can be done. I mean, I'm very interested in this theory that young people have become much more sensitive, perhaps sensitive is the word, but they've been much more anxious, and they've become much more prone to mental illness or mental unwellness of some kind, you know. And I keep thinking about that, and I wonder, how can I kind of develop that idea? I know Jonathan Haidt has written a famous book, but it's very kind of American-based. So sometimes you marinate an idea, and it goes around and around, and you think about developing. And then sometimes you come to the conclusion, I'm not the person to write this. I don't know enough. I can't research it. And, you know, you can go on Google and look up a lot of stuff, but looking up stuff on Google is only one part of your research, because if you're just repeating what's on Google or what's on Wikipedia, which isn't always accurate by the way, you're just dipping into what everybody else knows. I mean, I think Google and Wikipedia are good for helping out and getting, you know, a name comes into your head. I was thinking the other day about Josephine Butler, who was a very interesting 19th century feminist who campaigned against young girls being trafficked into prostitution. And Google is very good for quickly telling me which years that she flourished, when she was born, when she died. So I think it's a terribly good checking for that point of view. But it's not to be dependent on. You have to bring something else, I think, to what you're doing. I do sometimes think, you know, we're very sophisticated nowadays, and there's a lot of very, very complex material out there. Sometimes we overthink things and become too sophisticated. When I first joined a Dublin newspaper as woman's editor, the editor said to me, look, write what you like, but I just want you to bear in mind the most successful feature we ever published was called How to Dye a Sheepskin Rug. And you know, all right, this is, it was in a country which wasn't very, very sophisticated at the time, I suppose. But that lesson has stayed with me, that sometimes something, there's still an interest in something that can be, might be quite simple and might be quite fundamental and sort of getting back to basics. So, you know, one shouldn't dismiss the simple and the everyday and the just fancy that. An old Fleet Street hand once said to me, anything that the reader says when he reads this in a newspaper and says, just fancy that, that's a story, you know. And I sometimes think of things like that. And I suppose because the format of the column that I write for the Oldie is a note in notebook form, as they say, where there are three or four items perhaps, then one can add in small quirky little observations, which of course isn't so suited to a sustained article about something longer. But I think the idea of the notebook format is I think interesting because it does give the reader a sort of choice of topics. You know, they mightn't be interested in one topic, but they might be interested in another. So style and tone and phrasing, as well as ideas, of course, all come up. And I think that what Harry said, you know, about the editor, that's absolutely true. But it's, the role of the editor is really important, actually, in your dealings, in your work as a journalist, or if you're writing a column. Because you, an editor, first of all, every piece of journalism needs another pair of eyes on the text, and the editor is the best person, you know, to be able to do that. And I think it's really marvellous if you can have some kind of relationship with the editor you're working with. It may not be the editor of the paper, by the way, or of the magazine. It may be the editor of the feature section or the art section or whatever you're working at. But to have a good, to have a communicative relationship is very, very valuable and very rewarding and really worth pursuing if you possibly can. Again, in times gone by, an editor would take you out often. In fact, in old Fleet Street, the editor would take you to really quite a posh restaurant in Soho, which was marvellous.
Those days are gone.
Absolutely, yeah. But, you know, even a cup of coffee, you know. But it's nice to have a cup of coffee because sometimes the chemistry between people is important. And I think a good editor knows what he wants, or she, and they sometimes won't like what you like, what you're writing, and that's important too because they need to give you a little touch on the tiller, you know. We won't go with that angle, Mary. You know, we might do something else. That's important, and it's not a correction to you. You mustn't ever take that personally. You know, it's creative actually. Be able to do that, and as I say, it's my great regret is that we don't have so much face-to-face contact anymore. But so, if you are pitching, or if you are, you know, wanting to write a column for a magazine, be it the Oldie or any other magazine or any other newspaper, do try to develop a relationship with the commissioning editor, whom you know you're working with. I suppose the other thing about journalism in any kind is, you know, sort of it's actually keeping it up, it's actually sustaining it, is I suppose really the long term challenge. And ideas, there are only so many ideas in the world in the end. Is it Christopher Booker who developed this idea? There are only seven plots, actually, even in dramas. But nevertheless, these ideas do come back again and again. There's a question about, you know, are you repeating yourself in revisiting an idea? And I think it's inevitable that you are, because these events come back. I mean, I mentioned the Ruth Ellis thing. These events come back again and again, and the same things happen again and again. I see so much, you know, when I see young people demonstrating about Gaza or Ukraine and so on, I really do think all that goes back to the 60s, the notion of demonstration, and how... So we can't but repeat. Of course, you know, Sam Goldwyn, the very famous Hollywood mogul, you know, he was told once, look, we can't make this movie because it's been made before, you know, this, and Sam Goldwyn said, look, if they like it once, they'll love it twice. He also famously said, on another occasion, he was told, you can't make this movie, you know, because the heroine is of the book is a lesbian. And Sam Goldwyn said, well, turn her into an American. So, you know, he was quite, in his pithy ways, you know, he was quite accurate. So I did, one will revisit the topics, but I think you have to try and see a fresh angle, or an angle which is more relating to modern life or to modern circumstances, and sort of see it in that way. Harry talked about people writing about their own lives, and I do think your own life is often everybody's got a story to tell, really, basically. When, you know, we know that from our experience of life, everyone has something extraordinary in their lives to write about. But there's a certain amount of, you know, you can get to a point of almost self-cannibalism there, you know, where you're trying to draw on your own life all the time, and there's only so much you can actually draw on in your own life. And there's also an area where, you know, it may be awkward for your family or your friends to be too intimate. That's a fine judgment that has to be made. But it is an area of, you know, I mean, after all, does that not go back to St. Augustine and the you know, writing about yourself, writing your reflections and your memoir, your experience of life? And I suppose we've all drawn on that, you know, and I certainly have in my time. And then we women writers, more than men, but sometimes male writers too, write about their families and their children and their grandchildren. And I suppose, you know, that is also can be kind of fruitful, although I do remember my own poor son saying to me, Mum, please, just don't be embarrassing. Please. And indeed, despite all my warnings, they've become journalists too. And I suppose the thing that I find I do get anxious and worry about a lot, and is the whole area of new technology that's absolutely exploding around us. And I'll be very interested to hear Elizabeth Leward talking about Substacks this afternoon, because that's another. That's a fruitful area. I mean, one of my sons, Ed West, he has a successful Substack, and it can work very well. So, I mean, that's another area to develop. But I had dinner with friends last night, and a lot of the conversation was about artificial intelligence and how it is will sort of take over. That it's getting to the point where, you know, it can be sentient or it can do almost anything that we can do ourselves. And I think that's an area to look out for, you know, and the whole point of algorithms, you know, is another field which is affecting journalism. I write for an Irish paper, the Irish Independent, and they now have a system of algorithms. So when they put up your article, the management, whoever they are, they monitor how many clicks your article is getting according to the algorithm. So they know, you know, they know what the readership feedback is, or they've also got something called sustained readership attention. So they not only know the clicks, but whether the reader has read the bloody thing to the end. Which is really, really quite frightening, I think, in a way. And I suppose it may lead editors and media bosses to hire people who get the most clicks. And there's, you know, getting a lot of clicks is a good, I suppose it's a measure of success, of course it is. But nevertheless, there are other reasons to have a columnist or a writer in any outlet. You know, there are reasons of knowledge, of, if you like, of niche appeal and of style of writing and of personality, a whole range of reasons why you might want somebody in your newspaper, even for status. I mean, remember Peter Jay, who became ambassador to Washington. I think he was asked at one stage, you know, his writing was very difficult. He wrote about economics, and the editor said, you know, Peter, it's very hard to read, to understand what you're writing sometimes. It's too complicated. And he apparently said, well, I only write for three readers, the Prime Minister, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and the Governor of the Bank of England. You know, so he was only aiming. Well, he probably wouldn't survive in the world of algorithms and clicks. So that's coming down a way. But I think, on the other hand, I think sometimes things happen in a reverse way that you don't expect. And because of, you know, my increasingly long life, I've seen things turn out differently from what they were kind of predicted. I mean, I remember the time when people said the cinema would destroy the theatre. Well, you can't get into a London theatre these days, you know, even though it's £200 a seat or whatever it is. Then they said, you know, that television would destroy radio. Well, radio absolutely, you know, flourishes and thrives, and there's even oldie radio. And so sometimes there's a reverse reaction to things. And I sometimes think that the more there is artificial intelligence, the more the robots take over, maybe the more we will cherish the human touch. Maybe it'll become more valuable to be a sort of even an eccentric human in some way. You know how it is when you ring up some provider or some corporate organization or some airline or something to try to complain when something's gone wrong. You know, you go through all the procedures of press this and press that, and this is your choice now, and first you get a robot, and that's with my own bank. First you get a robot. Eventually you get a human being. You think, how marvellous! I've got a human being on the line. So maybe we should think that way in terms, but that the human will be more valued. And some people are saying that you know, it's the jobs which will be valued are the ones that require the human touch, the nurse at the hospital who cools your brow, if you like, or somebody who provides a caring experience, or somebody who provides something different, whereas it's perhaps things like accountancy, actually, which I always thought was a really good, stable career. They may be more affected because the robots may be more likely to take over in that kind of field. So we don't know what's going to happen, but we hope for the best. So I'd just like to bring this part to a close by saying, you know, that I do believe in the printed word. I do believe, you know, people love to, you know, respond to the printed word. I do believe that there is a rich field out there where there's opportunity to publish, opportunity to write, and opportunity to think and to develop ideas and to make a contribution of in your own field what you know best about. And that is, of course, the most famous advice that's always given, and it was the advice was given to my friend Maeve Binchy when she started to write novels. She said, write about what you know. And I think to begin with a columnist, that is the best advice, actually. Write about what you know and what you're interested in and so on, and you can develop it on from there. thank you very much for listening to me, and I hope to engage in some conversation with you now, what to pursue this with questions and answers. Thank you.
You have been listening to Radio Aldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Aldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.